Thank you for joining us, and I'm here with my friend Omar Abubakar, who is probably the nation's number one expert on the use of opioids and pain treatments in oral surgery. He's a professor and chair of the Department of Oral and Maxillofacial Surgery at Virginia Commonwealth University. Thank you, Omar.
Thank you.
It's great for you to be here.
Thank you for having me.
And explaining all of the news and what we've heard about risk factors and in opioid administration to dental patients, especially patients who have had wisdom teeth removed. And you're the expert in that. Can you explain what's going on in that field?
So one of the high risk of exposure to opioids is age, because young people, especially those who present to the oral surgery office for wisdom teeth or for some dental procedure, usually they are opioid naive patients, meaning they have no exposure, previous exposure to opioid. So the first exposure could be detrimental in having them progress into what we call long-term use, and from long-term use to misuse and possible addiction. So, and the population of patients that oral surgeon prescribed medication for is a large percentage of them are from that population. So they are by definition a higher risk population for prescription opioid. And I think oral surgeons and dentists should be aware of that. That is just not like other patients, adult patients. And I think that's where the risk comes from.
So they're a high risk, and the standard of practice before the opioid epidemic was you take somebody's wisdom teeth out and you'd give them opioids. Is that pretty
that correct?
Much it?
That's correct. That's correct. There's no concern, not intentional, but naive knowledge from oral surgeons and dentists that this population of patients would not be addicted the same way as, you know, 50-year-old don't get addicted with short-term use. We're finding that this patient exposure, this young people exposure to this addictive substance, even on a short-term basis, is detrimental compared to that of older population.
So what would a typical prescription for opioids look like in the old days when they take your wisdom teeth and they give you a script? What would it look like?
Yeah, the average number of tablets per prescription that was given to young people, even the initial prescription, is about 20 tablets. Some people write for more, some people write for less. Believe it or not, even with what we have now, there are still some people who prescribe that number of tablets. So the word out there is not completely among all oral surgeon dentists that this 20 tablets should be, you know, thing of the past. It's not thing of the past. In many places, it's still the present. I think for those who are educated on the issue or in contact with the literature, with the culture, what's going on in our country, have changed their views to some degree. And some of them gradually decrease the number of tablets. Some of them eliminate opioid altogether from their practice.
So the one reason to change prescribing practices among oral surgeons would just be to reduce the number of opioid prescriptions out there, because they tend to find a user. They tend to stay around in people's houses and shelves, medicine cabinets, and so forth. But another that from your work is that really you can manage this kind of pain without giving opioids. And you've presented an alternative approach.
Yes, and credit goes to other institutions and other oral surgeons around the country who have done the same thing. So it's just not my own experience that depending on opioid as a first line has become part of the past in my practice and in many other practices, that the first line of treatment would be non-steroidal, long-term local anesthetic, preemptive non-steroidal, combination of non-steroidal and acetaminophen. So there are many combinations before you get to the last resort, and the last resort would be opioid. And it's been successful. I think the barrier to changing a lot of the practices, it's probably a mental barrier more so than a practical or scientific one. The evidence base coming out telling us that the majority of this patient could do without the opioid. And those who would need opioid would need opioid for a short period of time and probably minimal number of tablets, on the average between 7 and 8 tablets.
That's a big difference.
It's a big difference. And a difference that may consequential, because even if they use those, they found that the average number of tablets, when they give them 20 and check on them a week later to ask them what's left, they calculated, and what they use is about between 6 and 8 tablets. So that meant even when they use the opioid, that's all you need. So that meant that if we give 6 or 7, and even if they use them, there's nothing left behind, and which is the key to all this, is that this leftover that could be shared with friend in high school or party, and this is where the troubles come from, is sharing the excess leftover opioid.
So the first reason to change practice is public health reason, because we're in the midst of an opioid epidemic. The second is there's alternatives that are not opioids that are equally effective. And the third, from your own data, is untreated, how many people will what's the natural history of that pain? Is it so incapacitating, or does it last for such a long period of time? What is the natural history?
I think what we need to remember is that the pain following third molar surgery or wisdom teeth is different from one individual to the other. And I think that dictates that each person or each patient should be treated differently. Some may need only ibuprofen or non-steroidal. Some may need the combination of both. Some may need a backup rescue medication of opioids. And I think the natural history is that within 2 days, the level of pain is manageable with non-steroidal anti-inflammatory agent. That in combination, either alone or in combination of acetaminophen. So even when opioid is needed, is not needed beyond the first 24 to 48 hours. And therefore, the expectations if we give somebody a prescription, they're going to use them for the whole week is not an accurate one.
You know, it's remarkable to sit with you, and here you are an OMF surgeon, and you were always talking about substance use disorder and evaluating the whole patient. Does that apply to you? You teach your students at VCU to take comprehensive addiction histories, and, you know, give us some advice on that.
Oh, yes. And it's fulfilling and gratifying, because the outcome for young students and residents, people who are still in training, is very positive one. And to the extent that their management of pain, they come out, graduate from dental school and from the residency with different opinions than those who graduated in earlier generation. We talk about treating pain, using pharmacological agent, to whether it's non-steroidal or combination with somebody else or opioid, it's only part of the formula. It's just like the middle of that is the pharmacological, but the periphery and the introduction would be the discussion with the patient and the family before even the procedure start, and then you close it at the end by another discussion with the patient and the family about expectations of pain and how we manage it, and what the expectation, and what happened if the prescribed medication doesn't work, then here's what we're going to do. So it's not, I think, assuring the patient and the family that nobody's going to suffer through the process. And in my mind, it's really balancing between compassion for patient care by managing their pain and not suffering, and patient safety. And it's a balance that's easy to achieve, and it's achievable, and it behoves us not to do it every single time with every single patient. Patient need to know that you are not letting them out there suffering. And to me, that is in itself assuring to patient that no matter what discussion you have with them, they'll trust you, that even if you say you're not going to have any medication, there is a chance that they trust you on that and they will go along with it. And I find that rewarding, actually, because I have this fear throughout my whole career that if I don't give them medication, they're going to be upset with me. And if they, you know, and if I If I enter the discussion about not getting opioid, they would suspect or think that I'm suspicious of them or their kids. That is not the case anymore. The case is that the public are much more open-minded, willing, and trusting to what the doctors say. And that is including, you know, pain management in a comprehensive way.
So like at the medical school, you teach about addictions, and you know about addiction capabilities in your community and state. It would maybe be unusual for people to hear that a prominent OMF surgeon and dentist would be referring people for addiction treatment and knowing about addiction resources like you do. Is that something you'd encourage all doctors to do?
I encourage, you know, of course, as I said before, I came to it from a different angle. Believe it or not, I wrote two textbooks, and none of them was an opioid. And the last thing I thought to going to be is talking about opioid. But I came to it in ways that through the compassion for patient and being a good doctor. I always wanted to be a good doctor, and I find that being non-judgmental, that's combining therapies and talking to patient and including patient into the treatment and the role of a stigma and role of medical professional and interaction with medical profession is very rewarding and made me better doctor. You know, it's a hard way to get to it, but made me better doctor. I do refer a patient to treatment because just like if I find out that they have diabetes or have hypertension or heart disease, I refer them for treatment. I figured this is another chronic disease. As a culture, there's nothing that is not chronic. Every disease is a chronic disease, and a chronic disease that we could survive, it is treatable, and should be no stigma attached to it. We don't have a stigma attached to many of the other chronic disease, and an addiction should be just like that. And because of that, I don't hesitate to discuss with the patient, to refer them to primary care, or to their doctor, or to addiction medicine. I made myself aware of the resources. I know the director of some of the addiction treatment clinics in town, and I made an effort to know them in person. So when I refer a patient, I give them my business card, and I say, I'm right on the back of it, the name of the doctor and the phone number. And it's very rewarding because I feel like I'm not just treating the mouth anymore. I'm treating the whole well-being of the patient.
Well, that's just the way it should be. It's the ideal. I'm not just treating the mouth anymore. I mean, that's, I'll remember that.
Yes.
And I'm sure it is really gratifying. You've saved a lot of people's lives.
If I saved only one life, it would be all worth it.
So there's a recent study that says if we don't do anything about the opioid crisis, we'll lose 500,000 more Americans. We lose 50,000 plus a year. And that's a number to people. But almost everyone knows someone who's been impacted by addiction. And many of us know someone who's died as a result of their opioid use. And sadly, that's happened in your family.
Yes. And in fact, I came to this issue through that because when I found out my 21-year-old son was addicted, it was total shock to me. I had a total shock to me because I didn't know what the signs before, because I may have, if I knew that, I would have recognized it. And my son went through treatment, so it kind of allowed me to think, you know, there's a treatment for it. And it really through my son that I learned to some degree, the compassion for the disease and compassion for patients affected by the disease. My son we find out that he was addicted to heroin. He had shoulder surgery, and he was prescribed medications about 6 months before. They may have some other issues, maybe with alcohol, but really he was a functional kid. That there's no evidence of any major substance use disorder. But 6 months after his shoulder surgery is when I found out that he was addicted to heroin. And we admitted him for treatment and went on to recovery and then relapsed and died. And I remember vividly during his recovery time, we had many conversations about addiction as a disease. And he almost taught me about the disease. as if he was going to introduce me to a topic of none of my choosing. And I remember, if I may tell the story, that I asked him when I first found out who gave him the medicine or who gave him the heroin. And he said, it doesn't matter, Dad. So I pushed him until he gave me a name. And then he, just a name, code name, I suspect, then went on, during recovery, came back and we had a conversation and he said, you remember the kid I told you about? He brought it up, so-and-so. I said, yeah. And he said, he died. And I said, good. And then he said, Dad, that's not right. You know, he's an addict, he's sick, he's a patient. And he has a mom and he has a dad. I'll never forget that, because, you know, I'm a doctor. I'm not supposed to be saying yes for somebody who died. I'm supposed to be into business of saving lives. I'm supposed to be, you know, compassionate. And you know, that after he died, after my son died, I cried for that, for my son, and for that kid, I'm sorry. But you know, it went on to go to school to find out what is it that I'm so clueless about that I was so not even a doctor. And I went to school for a year, an addiction study, graduate school addiction study. I learned this is a chronic disease, just like a lot of the other chronic diseases. And I learned that there's a treatment for it and these are patients and we, all the things, and it triggered me to go and educate people that are ignorant as me before I was subjected to that tragedy. And really, this is what I do now. Like I said, I travel everywhere I asked, and I don't keep my honorarium, if I say this, I put it into a fund for education about addiction, because I said it'd make me sick in my stomach to teach, to make a living out of my own tragedy. But I'm interested into the education. I'm gonna teach and educate everybody who listen about the issue for as long as I do, because I don't want one parent, I know that parents or not, I don't want parents to go through what I went through. And that was my journey. Sorry about that.
You know, thank you very much for being so open and honest and sharing, but in addition, for your new life's work, which is meaningful, and you're having a huge impact, and you have a voice that is more than just a technical expert, it's an emotional and experiential expert.
Yes.
Like people forget when they talk about the 50,000 people who've died, what is left behind. And it's a lot of trauma and grief and sadness, and everyone's affected by that.
I do speak, Mark, thank you for giving me the opportunity, because I speak on behalf of the mother who may not even have a TV interview, for the father that out there that ashamed of telling people that his son died. I want people to go out and speak about the issue, because as long as we hide it, as long as the stigma continue, and as long as the stigma continue, people are not going to seek treatment, and when they seek treatment, they treat it differently. And I speak on behalf, not only myself, but in behalf of every parents who had suffered the tragedy that I suffered and traveled the journey that I travel.
So I'd like to thank everybody for being with us for this educational program, and for my friend Omar.
Thank you very much.
Thank you for being here and helping us understand the important role that OMF surgeons and dentists might play in prevention and education, as well as the important role of medical education, and then the important role of the survivors in telling the story and making sure that it makes a difference. Thank you very much.
Thank you.